certainly say a hearty amen to that prayer. We are living in a world where this subject is not one that's discussed oftentimes. One of the reasons is because people don't like to discuss it. And because if a church is focusing on simply numbers and size, this is not the kind of topic that's going to increase your numbers. And so are we interested in truth? That's the question. When you talk about marriage, Levi mentioned how touchy a subject it is, and certainly if someone's in a situation where it may involve an unscriptural marriage or the potential of that, you start looking at 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, it seems like a long time to either have to live a celibate life or be divorced if you're in an unscriptural marriage or whatever it may be. I don't know about you, but it's helpful for me to contemplate what we talked about Sunday morning, and that is the brevity of life. When you think about the fact we're just a breath, we're just a watch in the night, we're just a yesterday, compared to the eternal God and what lies before us, that will help us be able to do what we prayed with Levi, and that is to stand firm in God's laws. We are seeking to understand what the Bible says. We're not working from any kind of Church of Christ manual. I have printed literature. It's my efforts to help those who want to study. That literature is not authoritative. You're not obligated to agree with it. We encourage your input and questions. And so we're just interested in a pursuit of truth. The same is true in our study tonight. For those of you who've been in the class, I want to start tonight with a question about marriage. What is marriage? Sir? A covenant is involved in marriage, but marriage is not a covenant. Okay, it's a relationship. This is important. Between a man and a woman. Marriage is a relationship. Now, they enter into that relationship by covenant, which is a good point, and consummate that covenant in sexual union. So it's a covenant to be one's intimate companion. All right, so that's what marriage is. Now, why that is important is because when we talk about the word divorce, if marriage is a relationship between a man and a woman, what is divorce? Severing that relationship. So once we get a clear concept, Levi prayed that we would understand God's word clearly, and I appreciate that. Marriage is a relationship. Divorce is the severance of that relationship. So where you agreed to be one's intimate companion, now you either leave that relationship or put the other person away as your companion. And we've studied verses where that very terminology is used. All right, we're to a point of our study, if you have your copy of your lesson, about civil law. What part does civil law play? That's where we stopped, wasn't it? Those of you who were in the class, I believe that's correct. All right, so let's begin with Deuteronomy chapter 24. I don't know because I don't have the class copy. I've got the teacher's copy. Page 14? 16. 16, okay. Page 16. That's a good question, David. Thank you. All right, look at Deuteronomy 24. Sometimes the idea is that divorce does involve civil law, and one of the verses sometimes used is this verse. Let's look at it. When a man takes a wife, what is that phrase synonymous with? Marriage. And that's what the next phrase is. And, namely, marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he's found some indecency in her, And he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house. So the certificate of divorce, it states what he did. What did he do? Last part of the verse. Sends her out from his house. This certificate, who wrote this certificate? Who wrote it? I want to know who wrote it. He writes this on a piece of paper. I want to know who wrote it. Was it a judge in a court of law? The husband wrote it. Got a piece of paper, and he wrote this on a piece of paper. You're no longer mine. I don't take you anymore. I don't know what he put on it. We're through. I don't know. But the idea is we're no longer married. We're no longer in this relationship. Now, what was the purpose of this piece of paper? It tells you in the verse.
Send her
what?
Send her out of town.
Well, the paper didn't send her out. That, what does the paper do? It certifies. A certificate certifies, doesn't it? If your child attends school all year, perfect attendance, they get a certificate. What does it do? Is it the attendance? It just certifies what happened. That's all. He writes her a certificate so she can go to the next man. Under the old law, a man could have more than one wife, a woman could not have more than one husband. So before anybody else marries that woman under this law, he has to be sure she's not married. So this little piece of paper certifies that he's put her away. Some years ago in the Houston paper, I believe it was, maybe it was on the web, I think it's in the Houston paper, there was an article how Jewish men, and I don't know if it was in current Israel or what part of the world, I think it was, that's what they were doing to be hard on their wives. They would put them away, but they wouldn't give them the certificate until they were past the age of childbearing. In other words, just being mean is what they were doing. And that woman couldn't go get remarried. Was she divorced? Yes, but she had no certificate. And so he writes her a certificate of divorce. Now I ask you the question. Are civil courts or an appeal to civil courts anywhere in this passage?
No.
In the Old Testament, if they wanted to talk about taking something to what we would call civil court, are you familiar with what kind of terms would be used? They would go to the gates of the city, or to the elders, or to the judges of that city. Nothing about that in this text. The man writes on a piece of paper, "You're no longer my wife." And that certifies what happened. What if he did not give her a certificate of divorce, but sent her out of the house? Is she divorced? No?
She is, but she doesn't have any proof of it.
Do you have any proof of it, but is she divorced?
Yes.
Yes. If your child doesn't get a certificate of perfect attendance, does that mean they didn't have perfect attendance?
No.
No. The certificate and the action are two different things. And if he sends her out from his house and he doesn't give her a certificate, that doesn't in any way affect the fact that their relationship has been severed. She is divorced. Nothing in this text about civil law. Turn to First Corinthians 7. When we studied marriage, we saw that civil law didn't make a marriage, and it certainly doesn't break a marriage. And First Corinthians 7 Verse 10, to the married I give instructions, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried. She leaves. This letter is written to a church composed, there may have been some Jews, but many Gentiles. Does Deuteronomy 24 apply to these people? It does not. She leaves. Nothing about a certificate, a piece of paper, a court, anything. My question is, are they still married in God's eyes?
They're still married.
They're still married? Text says they're unmarried. What makes you think they're still married? What am I missing?
You're not missing anything. We're just so used to society regulating marriage.
It says if she leaves, let her remain what?
Unmarried.
Unmarried. If she was once married, she's now unmarried, and her mate is still alive, what's another word to describe her state? Divorced. She's divorced. The word leave here is a different word than the word translated divorce in Matthew 5 and 19, but it is the same idea. So she leaves. Now she's unmarried. The relationship is severed. As we're going to study this text in more detail when we get to the passages. By the way, the lesson for the passages is on the table in the back. You want to get a copy of that. And we're going to go back through these passages and plug in our definitions. But you see a little bit further in the text, in verse 12, to the rest I say, not the Lord, that is, he's dealing with mixed marriages. The Lord didn't specifically address mixed marriages, although what he said applied to them. We'll study that when we get here. That if any brother has a wife who is unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. But now look verse 15. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. You may not be able to control whether they leave or not. Because a covenant, we talked about this in our last class, a covenant requires the will of how many? At least two. The severance of a covenant requires the will of how many? One. That's right. So, this woman in verse 11, I don't know if her husband wanted her to leave or not. It's really immaterial. Just like in verse 15. There's a man who's a pagan. His wife obeys the gospel. He said, let's go partying. It's New Year's Eve. Let's go drinking, dancing. She says, sweetheart, I can't do that. He said, goodbye, I'm through with this marriage. I'm out of here. What can she do? Nothing. And so those kind of situations, not the New Year's Eve thing, but whatever they might have wanted to do would bear on their marriage. Okay. We're going to look at two more terms. We said there are four terms that are critical. Marriage, divorce, adultery, and fornication. This term we're looking at now is critical. It's going to be critical to our passages when we study Matthew 5 and Matthew 19 and Romans 7. So let's look at this word adultery. Now what we could do to define the word adultery, well, let's say you're studying the Bible, you come across this word. What's one way to find out what it means?
Look it up in a dictionary.
Look it up in a dictionary. But what's the problem with that?
That's how we
define the word. How people use the word today doesn't mean that's the way it was used in the first century. A dictionary simply reflects current usage. And 10 years from now, you may pick up a dictionary and the definition be different. So dictionaries are useful, but beware of their use. Let's say there's another way. We could go get a Greek lexicon. And we could look up the word adultery. How many of you have a Greek lexicon? I see a few hands, so the rest of you are just out.
You got a lexicon?
A what?
Strong's a lexicon?
If you want to use the term loosely. It has some Greek definitions, but it's very basic. Very Strong's, it can be useful, but it's dangerous. Any lexicon is dangerous, and here's why. First of all, if you don't have a lexicon, and I'm going to define adultery by lexicon, I tell you, Thayer's lexicon defines this word as, where does that leave you? You have to take my word for it. Then here's the danger of that. People never read the preface to lexicons. If you have one, go read the preface or the foreword. Whether it's Vine's Expository Dictionary or Thayer's, whichever one you have. They will tell you in the foreword that this is not only a lexicon, it is also a commentary. Thayer's lexicon, the way those words are defined is they study documents and letters and those kind of things from back that time period, say, here's how that word was used. They give you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 definitions. When they do that, they're authoritative because they're studying the documents that shows how those words were used. But then, they have to decide which of those 5 definitions the passage you're studying falls under. Now they're a commentator. Unless it's a matter of syntax or grammar. Furthermore, if you use a Thayer's lexicon, the definitions are in italics, the comments are in regular print. I wonder how many people that own a Thayer's lexicon are aware of that. So you quote a Thayer's lexicon, a preacher quotes a Thayer's lexicon. Say, boy, that's great. You don't know if it's the definition or the comment. So I'm not saying don't use a lexicon. They can be useful. You know, a hatchet can be useful, an axe can be useful, but you can also cut your foot off with it. And so a lexicon can be useful if we know how to use it. But there's a better way to define words. And that is simply define where these words occur in the Bible, where there's a context around it that help us define it. That's what we're going to do with the word adultery. We're going to turn to some passages where this word occurs and see if there's something around it that helps give us a sense of what was meant. Let's start in Ezekiel chapter 16. One of the things we encourage in Bible study is comparing versions. And you'll note there on your lesson I have King James Version and American Standard Version. In Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 32, since we have one dedicated King James Version person here, we'll let her tell us what that version translates there. What does it say, Sally?
Which word are you looking for?
Just 16:32.
The whole verse?
Yes.
But as the wife that committeth adultery, which taketh strangers instead of her husband.
Okay, a wife that committeth adultery. The New American Standard Version and the New King James Version says an adulterous wife. So here's an adulterous wife. It's a woman who commits adultery. What does she do that qualifies her as an adulterous woman? Okay, look at verse 30. Of course, this is an analogy the Lord is using to describe his relationship with Israel. And he's using the marriage analogy. But we can learn something about terms. Because he uses these terms of adultery and whoredom and term talking about marriage, you became mine, that help us understand what these terms meant relative to actual marriage. So anyway, here we have verse 30. What kind of actions does this woman engage in that is described in verse 32 as the acts of an adulteress. Take strangers instead of her husband. So they need breakfast. She just takes them in and feeds them breakfast. What does verse 30 say? You're right. Your answer is not wrong. A bold-faced harlot. Verse 30. You know what a harlot is and what she does. This is the woman that's called an adulterous woman. So she might eat with a stranger, but that doesn't make her an adulteress. It's when she performs the act of a harlot with somebody else. In verse 33, again, you see the idea of harlotries. Now, if you want to take the time, you can go through the entire chapter, starting down in like 25. Look at 25. Back in verse 8, do you remember we used verse 8 to define marriage? Do you remember what the phrase is in verse 8 that refers to marriage? You became mine. Remember, the husband leaves and cleaves, the wife is given and taken. They become one another. The phrase that's used of marriage in the Bible. You became mine. That is my wife. He had children by her. If it wasn't marriage, then it was an illicit relationship. So you became mine. But to become mine, you'll note, verse 8, he entered into a covenant with her. Remember, we said a covenant is one of the things that's requisite to entering this relationship. Okay, now when you get to 25, it says, you built yourself a high place at the top of every street, made your beauty abominable. So it's like a woman that's inviting this kind of conduct. What he's talking about is idolatry, how they worshiped other gods and invited the idolatry of the nations around. But note he says, you spread your legs to every passerby to multiply your harlotry. Pretty clear what he's talking about, isn't it? But now we know, at least in this chapter, when he talks about a woman that committeth adultery or is an adulterous woman, what kind of action she's involved in. It's a sexual act. It's a sexual act that should be reserved for marriage, but now is being engaged in with someone else. All right, go to chapter 23. God, again, is using this analogy. Chapter 23 and verse 44. All right, 23:33 says, when I said concerning her who was worn out by adulteries, will I now commit adultery with her when she is thus? What phrase describes that action in 44? Went into her as they would go into a harlot. You don't have to have a lexicon to understand what he means by adultery in 43, do you? It's pretty graphic explaining what he means by adultery. It's not something that happens at the courthouse. It's not something that the judge signs a paper. It's not just something in a person's mind. It's a sexual act. That's the way at least it's used in this text. Okay? Look at Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 8. Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 8. I saw that for all the adulteries of faithless Israel, I had sent her away, that's the northern kingdom, and given her a writ of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah, that's the southern kingdom, did not fear, but she went and was a harlot. And what's the last word? Also. So she did what the northern kingdom did. What was the northern kingdom did, first part of verse 8? Engaged in what?
Committed adultery.
Adulteries. She did that also. That is, acted like a harlot. So you can see that the word is defined contextually. Look at Leviticus chapter 20. Yes.
One of these passages, I think you comment on that, but I think it might be good for the pastor here again. A lot of these passages where you form a definition are being used figuratively to describe something. And some will argue, well, it's being used figuratively, not talking about a literal marriage, because it's talking about Israel and Judah. Can you really use these passages to understand what the words mean?
Okay, Rocky's question is a good one. These are people say, well, these are figurative uses. He's talking not actually about God literally married to Israel. That's right. But he's picturing it by what? What is he comparing it to? A literal marriage. And literal harlotry. And literal adultery. All we're looking at it for is definition of words. And that's a good question Rocky raises. So God wasn't literally married to Israel. And he's not talking about them literally, Israel or Judah, committing adultery. It was idolatry, is what he was talking about. They did commit literal immorality. The nation was corrupt. But that's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about idolatry. And the other nations are like other women, and they pursued their idols. Okay, good question, Rocky. Look at Leviticus 20. Did you have any follow-up on that, Rocky?
Just to add that if you're doing an analogy, and if the terms don't actually literally mean a marriage, how can you even make it? You start with something that people know, and you make an analogy, and if marriage is not, you can't use these words to understand it, you can't really make an analogy.
Excellent point. If they don't mean that, how can you make your point? Right. It's like a parable. You lay down something beside something people know. A sower went forth to sow. Well, he's not really talking about a sower and seed. But if you don't understand what a literal sower and seed is, you can't understand the truth over here. Right? And a good point that Rocky makes. All right. Look at Leviticus 20. In verse 10, if there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. Now, on your lesson, we encourage you to observe as you start reading down through here, other terminology is used describing the same kind of action, but different parties involved. All right, look. Verse 11. Verse 10 says, commit adultery with another man's wife. Verse 11, if there's a man who lies with his father's wife. Is that a different kind of action from verse 10, or a different person involved? See, his father's wife. Same action, described this time as lying with. That's what adultery is. But this time he used the term lie with. Same thing in 12. A man who lies with his daughter-in-law. Same action, different person involved. Verse 13. If a man who lies with a male. Different party, same kind of action. Verse 14, just kind of an interesting thing. If a man who marries a woman and her mother, it is immorality. Both he and they shall be burned with fire. We talked about marriage consummated by sexual union. If that's not true, when he marries her, it's not necessarily an act of immorality, is it? You can see it's just understood that marrying involves the sexual act. Okay, and then verse 15, man who lies with an animal. And then verse 17, who takes his sister, and the idea of taking here is to, he uses this term, see nakedness. That was a euphemism for the sexual act that they used. And so then verse 18, lies with the mistress woman, 20, lies with his uncle's wife, etc. So you can see at the head of this in verse 10, commit adultery with, synonymous with lying with these other parties. Again, clearly indicating a sexual act. Now, we have on your lesson, it's not ceremony or civil state. Sometimes preachers will define that word that way. As an adultery is what takes place when the judge signs the paper, which you go down to the courthouse. That's adultery. You broke the covenant by signing this paper or whatever. These verses we're reading, I don't see that in them myself. Maybe somebody can help me with that. Look at Job 24. Job 24. Job may be the oldest book in your Bible. Job talks about an adulterer. What does the adulterer wait for? What does he wait for? Night. Good grief, courthouse closed. You can see this is not something that takes place at the courthouse. The adulterer waits for the eye of the adulterer waits for the twilight, saying, "No one will see me," and he disguises his face. In the dark, they dig in the houses and shut themselves up by day. They do not know the light. They think the darkness will hide their actions. I don't know why people think God can't see at night, but people act like they serve that kind of God. of course, God goes blind on New Year's Eve, so people can worship God all year and get drunk on New Year's Eve, and I guess it's okay. Okay, so obviously this is not characteristic of a ceremony, not characteristic of legal ceremonies. That's our next point there. In John chapter 8, verse 4. What we're seeing, whether you go to the Old Testament or New Testament, you see this idea in the Word seems to be consistently referring to some kind of act that someone's engaged in. In Acts chapter 8, verse 4, they said, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act." They got her when she's before the judge. Is that it? No. The sexual act. And so you see again, adultery was understood to be some kind of an action. Now, then I make the point here, which Rocky has alluded to, figuratively used to denote spiritual unfaithfulness. That's the way it's used in the Old Testament. A word is literal unless there's something that points to its figurative use, and that's clear in those passages we used. But we've got to be careful. I have on your lesson the word body is used figuratively of the church, isn't it? So can I go to 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 3, absent in body? So he was absent from the church? No. So when body, while body may be used, the human body as an analogy for the church for different reasons, 1 Corinthians 12, to show how each member is important to the whole, in Ephesians 1, to show Christ is the head of it, and thus rules the body, various points being made. But the word body itself, unless there's something to indicate figuratively, is still literally the human body. Okay. Now, Romans 7 is critical. So if you see something wrong with my reasoning here, I want you to tell me what it is. Okay? This is critical, at least to my understanding or misunderstanding, whichever the case may be, of what adultery is. So let's look at Romans 7. Begin in verse 1. Now again, marriage is not his main topic. His main topic is their relationship to the law, the jurisdiction of law. But to illustrate that, he's going to talk about marriage and the jurisdiction of the marriage law. Okay. And he says, "Do you not know, brethren?" It's something they're familiar with, in other words. For I'm speaking to those who know the law. You're familiar with this, Paul says. That the law has jurisdiction over a person as long as he lives. For, now here's his illustration. for. The married woman is bound by law to her husband. How long? While he is living. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law. That is, the law has no more jurisdiction over her and that relationship. He's gone. So she's released from the law concerning her husband. Now note the first three words of verse 3. What's said in verse 3 is contingent on verse 2. And we ask you that question in question number 2. The first question, the woman which has a husband is what? Bound by law to her husband. Bound by law. We'll talk more about that when we study Romans 7. So this is God's law pertaining to marriage. All right, now, it says, so then if, verse 3. And so then if, the logical import is, consequently, or the result of that, or under these circumstances. All right, so then if, while her husband is living. So if her husband's living, go back up to verse 2. What about the law? She's bound by law to the first man, right? Her husband's living. She's bound by law to him. Then it says she is joined to another man. We studied that in another class. What's the meaning of this joined to another man? Married to another man. So she's married to the second man, who she bound to. First man. A woman can be married to one man, but by the law of God be bound to another man. We say, what does bound mean? We'll talk about that. That's important to understand. I just want you to see what the text says. Married and bound are not equivalents. And what makes her an adulteress is that she's married to one man while bound by law to another man. That's what the text says. So then if, while her husband's living, she joined to another man, she should be called an adulteress. But now what happens if her husband dies? She is free from the law. So, we ask you the question. We just answered number 3. So number 4, according to verse 3, a woman bound by law to one man while married to another is an adulteress. First man dies. She remained married to the second man, but it is no longer adultery. Why? Not bound by law. Is she still married to the second guy? Yes. So it's not the marriage in and of itself. It's not the sexual act in and of itself. It's the fact that she's having this sexual act with one man while still bound by law to another man. That's not my definition. That's the text. He said if her husband dies, she's free from the law so that she is no longer an adulteress. Isn't that what it says? That doesn't mean she's not guilty of her past adultery. But her relationship with the second man is no longer adultery. Why? What's changed? Bound by law. Okay? In 1 Corinthians 7, 39. Same writer, same subject, same words. One way to define Bible words is by contrast. Well, let's look at chapter 7, 39. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives. Same as Romans 7. But if her husband is dead, what changes? She's what now? Free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. So when she's bound, what then, based on this verse? She is not free to be married to whom she wishes. So back to Romans 7, she's married to one guy, But she's still bound by God's law. God's law says you do not have the freedom to marry that second man. God's law says you don't. And when you sleep with that man, that's adultery.
And there's no second one. So does that exclude it?
What?
In 39, there's no exception clause there, exception for adultery. So does that mean, is that done away with?
No. In any Bible topic, you gather all the data to reach your conclusion. He just simply doesn't discuss it here. Okay, we'll pick up with fornication. We'll finish, hopefully, this lesson and get into the one on passages. So I sent everybody a PDF copy that you can download, or you can go to the website and download it in your word processor if you want that format, or there are just paper copies that are on the table in the back.